Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab, and today we're talking about...
Well, we're trying to think about what goes on in the mind of a bad person.
Yeah.
What makes a bad person so bad that he's different from the rest of us?
And we didn't really come to any kind of agreement with the Hobber thing.
Yeah, I don't think we quite...
Let's go.
But, you know, we ended up walking this question around to different people.
We want to talk about bad people in Shakespeare.
And oddly enough, we got a really interesting take on the true nature of badness from this guy.
James Shapiro, professor of English at Columbia University.
And he said, to start, you want to know about bad? I'll give you bad.
In Titus Andronicus, there's a character by the name of
Aaron the Moor.
And there's a moment in the play where Aaron gets up on stage, looks at the audience and says, let me just tell you the kinds of things I've been up to recently.
Set deadly enmity between two friends. Make poor men's cattle break their necks. Set fire on barns and haystacks in the night. And bid the owners quench them with their tears. Oft have I digged up dead men from their graves and set them upright at their dear friend's door.
Oh!
Even when their sorrows almost were forgot and on their skins as on the bark of trees, have with my knife, carved in Roman letters, let not your sorrows die, though I am dead.
Whoa.
So he's bad.
Yeah, but see, here's the interesting thing. According to James, he is not the baddest in Shakespeare or in life, because ultimately the play offers up a reason for his nastiness.
The reason why he's telling all this stuff is because he has cut a deal. They will spare his son if he fesses up and tells them what they need to know. So there's a way in which there's a touch, a spark of humanity.
Just a little glimmer. And he says, that's what people wanted. They wanted someone who was really thrillingly bad, but in the end was redeemed a bit.
Yeah.
And this wasn't just a theater thing.
No, because if you couldn't afford a ticket for a play, you'd seen all the plays, in the 1500s you could always go to a public hanging.
And you'd go.
For much the same reasons.
In those days, if you're a convicted male felon, you are, you know, strung up. But you're not allowed to hang until you die. You're cut down before then.
Warning, this next part's a little graphic.
Then the executioner castrates you, cuts you open, and takes out your internal organs and then separates your head, which is put on a post.
But even with all that gore and horribleness, there was often a moment that people waited for. And in a way, we wait for it still, even now.
We want what Elizabethans got at the scaffold, which was a confession. Before the guy is cut to shreds, he's allowed to confess. You know, I heartily, you know, regret the fact that I killed the young maiden or defamed the king, whatever it is. The expectation is somebody is made to make his peace with his maker before he dies. That's what you do.
And that's what Shakespeare did in all his plays. He would give all his baddies at least one moment where they could be understood.
Except this one time.
So will I turn her virtue into pitch.
Iago.
He is a soldier. He works for a general. The general's name is Othello. They're supposedly chums, but General Othello has no idea that Iago...
I hate...
Hates him.
So he plans to destroy Othello. Now, we don't exactly know why. There are hints of reasons, like maybe he thinks Othello's sleeping with his wife, we're not sure. But the weird thing is that he decides not just to take down Othello, but everybody.
I don't know what he did.
What?
Lie.
He stirs up hatred between friends, between lovers. He even schemes against his own wife.
This is just somebody who's performing brain surgery without anesthesia on other people. He's a master plotter.
And as for why?
Maybe Othello was sleeping with Amelia.
But as the play goes on, you begin to think that maybe that's just another lie.
Eventually, Iago convinces Othello that his wife has been disloyal, which she hasn't. And then Othello goes and kills his own wife, smothering her with a pillow.
This is just a tsunami of evil that passes through the play.
Desdemona's dead. Desdemona's dead.
And at the very end of the play, when everyone finds out what Iago's done, Othello asks him, why? Why did you do this? And Iago?
He refuses what we fully expect and what everybody on stage at that moment fully expects from him. You know, what does he say? Demand me nothing. What you know,
you know.
From this time forth, I never will speak word. I'm not saying a word. I'm not going to give you what you want. I'm not going to help restore the sense that there is a moral order to the world and a moral norm. What you know, you know.
If this is the singular moment in Shakespeare where he gives you an ununderstandably evil man, no motives, no reason, any idea what the hell he was intending?
What you know, you know.
Intending mystery.
Meaning, I mean, what, any idea what was in his mind? Was he trying to make a commentary on something? Was he grappling with something? Do
what
we know?
You know, you know.
Damn it!
The good Iagos make you want to shower the minute you leave the theater because you are sullied by them.
Thank you to James Shapiro, whose most recent book is called Contested Will.
You know what? You know what I'm left...
He has you there.
Yeah, well. You know what I'm left thinking, though, is like, if you could somehow... I mean, that was make-believe. But if you could somehow get a real Iago in the room and subject that person to questioning and really get them to sort of fess up as to why they did it, would that make a difference?
We should say that this next section of the program has some references which are extremely graphic and not to everybody's taste. So if you have kids in the room, maybe this is a time to tell them to go brush their teeth or something.
Yeah, yeah.
It comes to us from our reporter, Aaron Scott.
Aaron.
Yes.
Jeff Jensen.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
All right, so who is this guy we're hearing?
This is Jeff Jensen, and he's a reporter in L.A., and he wrote this graphic novel that I read about one of the most prolific serial killers in U.S. history.
Gary Leon Ridgway.
The Green River Killer.
The first victims of the Green River Killer were found in the summer of 1982.
The Green River murders terrorized Seattle in the 1980s.
In Seattle today, a man called the Green River Killer.
Ridgway murdered at least 49 women.
The so-called Green River Killer.
But it's suspected that it could be upwards of 75.
Wow.
Making him the most prolific serial killer in American history.
All the victims were prostitutes.
He buried them or left their bodies in these little clumps in the woods.
The killer seemed to have placed the bodies as if they were mannequins.
And in January of 1984, the Green River Task Force was formed. And my father was recruited to the task force.
So Jeff wrote this book because his father, Tom Jensen, was one of the lead detectives tracking Gary Ridgway. He ultimately spent 17 years searching for this man.
In December of 2001, my father and his colleagues make the arrest.
DNA testing matched him to the crime.
They arrest Gary Leon Ridgway, and on June 13, 2003, Gary was secretly taken out of his jail cell and brought to a sort of very nondescript, concrete, ugly office building. And
over the next 6 months,
from June to early December,
it was Tom's job to get Gary to open up
and give up the few details that they really needed to link him certifiably to all these crimes.
Today's date is June 17th, year 2003. The time now is 08:36 hours.
So every day they would bring him into this conference room.
This is a continuation of an interview with Gary Leon Ridgway.
And interrogate him.
Yeah, what have you remembered since we last talked yesterday?
I got those all at night, mostly. I remember picking her up at...
It immediately became apparent that there was going to be difficulties.
As far as I know, I don't know believe it or not.
He would deny things, he would obscure, he would dance around things.
He didn't really want a cop to everything that he did.
I gotta tell you, I'm not totally comfortable that you're providing all the information.
Especially when it came to one particular fact.
What my father and his colleagues know is that something was done to these bodies, many of them, after they were murdered.
Is he saying what I think he's saying?
Yeah.
Necrophilia. Gary is dancing around this topic. Gary had denied this to his own lawyers. So my father and the other interviewer in that room that morning, Detective John Mattson, they start using a line of a tact of interviewing him that was very...
It's okay. It's okay if you did.
Stunningly, shockingly empathetic.
Nothing to be ashamed of. Mm-hmm. Thousands of people have done it before you. You're not the first one.
You know, you're not the first person that's ever done this.
You're not going to be the last one.
You won't be the last?
That's one of the things that we need to know.
The father's trying to, like, reach out to him.
Okay. I know it was more than an urge.
It's okay to admit this. You need to admit this.
Okay. It's all right. Mm-hmm. But we've got to know that. That's one of the things we have to know. And that's why it's okay to let it out.
And he does.
Yes, I did lie about that. But that's when I was, I went back one time before, and I, I gotta give it out. I can't keep holding it.
No, it's building up.
This was a major breakthrough.
So he ends up admitting it.
In graphic detail.
And it gets even more disturbing for my father as the conversation suddenly pivots to another victim.
Other than one that was real close to me.
By the name of Carol Christensen.
Christensen, I dated her several times, two times before.
He brings her up as an example of a woman that he actually had strong feelings for.
You liked this girl.
Yeah, I really liked her. She was good to me.
And as it happens, my father has very vivid memories of investigating the Carol Christensen murder, speaking with Carol's mom, Carol's little daughter.
Killed her. She was, I knew she had a daughter.
And so, Gary starts going through this narrative of what he did to Carol.
The last time she was in a hurry.
She, like, was allegedly in a rush.
And she didn't...
And, like, it kind of, like, hurt his feelings.
Wasn't satisfying me. It made me mad because she wasn't very much in a hurry. She had something else on her mind. And I, you know, killed her.
What did you kill her?
I choked her. With my arm. And the way I killed her, I cared for her because I dated her before, but this... didn't turn out right.
Up until that point, Gary refused to say that from the minute I picked these women up, I wanted to kill them. He claimed they were in the middle of a sex act. He would get distracted. Something would happen. He just kind of went crazy. He had snapped. And almost like blaming the victims. And my father wasn't buying it.
Let's back up a little bit.
The fact that he kept on doing it over and over and over again was like, come on.
Been through this a lot of times before, and she's already told you she's in a hurry.
You knew what was going to happen.
And you've done this how many times before? 10, 15, 20 times. You know what's going to happen if she pisses you off. Mm-hmm. And you like her. You're telling us all this.
Yes.
Yet you go into this anyway, knowing full well that it could end up in her death.
And Gary just says,
yes.
That is true. When I picked them up, I was going to kill them. Finally acknowledging, yeah, that's true. There's a pause and my father just says,
why?
Why? Why did you do this?
Did you need to kill?
And that was a question that had haunted my father for decades.
Why?
In that one simple why that he asked Gary, there was a lot of questions he was asking. Why did you inflict all this suffering on them, on us? Why did you take these women off the streets and want to destroy them?
Why?
Why? And the answer is unsatisfying.
Yes, I did need to kill. I needed to kill her because of that.
Wait, what?
I just needed to kill because of that. And then he just trails off.
I need to kill because of that. That's it?
Yeah.
You know, I just wanted to kill him. I just needed to kill them. In that moment, my father, he stands up and he says,
"Touched me.
You've touched me, Gary.
You've touched me. Let me take a break."
Okay, we're going off tape now. It's 09:24 hours on June 17th, year 2003.
He walked out of the room and just started weeping.
They spent the next 6 months interrogating him. They brought in psychiatrists and forensic psychologists to try to get an answer. Gary says, "I needed to kill," and they go, "Why?" And he says, "Because of the rage." And, "Well, why the rage?" And, "Because women have stepped on me all my life." "Well, why can't you deal with it in a normal way?" Each answer just begs another why. And even though in the end they got him to confess to these 49 murders, they never really get any closer to an answer than this first one.
That afternoon, he gets in his car, goes home. He finds my mom on the deck, sits down next to her. She says, "What happened today?" And my dad said, "I don't want to talk about it." And to this day, they have not talked about that day. And he hasn't talked about it with anyone until I interviewed him for the book.
And why is it so important, do you think, to understand the why behind such an evil act?
Well, the thing that haunts me about the why question is that I'm reminded of like one of the oldest stories in the Bible, which is the story of Job. The story of Job is that one day God and Satan are having a conversation and they're saying, "Have you checked out Job? You know, I'm really proud of Job. He believes in me and he trusts me so much and he has such great faith in me." And Satan is like, I bet I can change his mind. And so Satan basically systematically destroys Job's life, takes away his wife, his children, all his material possessions. What follows is this ongoing conversation between Job and his friends about why does this happen? Why does God allow this to happen? Only then does God speak up and kind of say, like, "You're going to question me? Like, you know, who are you?" My point is, sometimes when we ask the why in the face of profound evil, I kind of wonder if what we're doing is that we're daring God to show himself. And I think what we want out of the why is meaning, meaning to life, to reveal itself in a way that restores order and gives us hope that all of this isn't just meaningless chaos.
Jeff Jensen's book is The Green River Killer, a true detective story. It's a graphic or an illustrated novel.
Thanks also to reporter Aaron Scott for that story.
This is Radiolab.
Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Dan Charles.
Hi, my name is Jeff Jensen.
Hey, it's Fred Kaufman.
I'm calling to read the credits. Here we go.
Radiolab is produced by Jad Abumrad.
Our staff includes
Ellen Horn,
Soren Wheeler,
Pat Walters,
Kim Howard,
Lynn Levy,
Brenna Farrell,
and Sean Cole.
With help from Adam Cole, Rachel James, and Matt Keelty.
Othello recording, courtesy of BAM,
Brooklyn Academy of Music, Ham Archive.
Special thanks to Louis Fleck, Eugene Thacker, Sierra Hahn, and everyone in the Manuscripts and Archives Department at Yale University Library. Thanks.
End of message.